Record reflect that the time is 3:26 and the date is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2005. Members present, Representative Guttenberg, Crawford, Roepberg, myself, Chairman Anderson, and I believe Representative Ledoux is on her way, and Representatives Scott and Lynn are excused. Today, we're going to postpone my bill, House Bill 150, the licensing of radiologic technicians, and so we'll have two bills, House Bill 7 and House Bill 147. House Bill 7 is the unemployment compensation benefits by Representatives Crawford and Guttenberg, members of the committee. I hope members can support listening to that. It's very similar to last year's and moving it out today. And then House Bill 147, it just states insurance, but it's by the governor, and I think we're just going to have a presentation today. I'm looking at Josh, and we'll hold the bill and just have a sectional analysis. So it's, I guess we'll go with House Bill 7, and just you can go ahead and you can stay there if you want. Or
oh, this will be fine. Fun. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet.
I almost feel bad about starting without Representative Ledoux, but I'll go ahead.
Please start, and we can summarize when she comes.
Down the last paragraph of our sponsor statement, it says, retaining a well-trained Alaskan workforce is essential for a strong economy. Providing an overdue increase in the weekly benefit amount is necessary to keep Alaska's workers in Alaska. Linking the method for future benefit calculations to average weekly earnings will ensure any changes are in concert with Alaska's economy. The reason why we chose the average weekly wage as opposed to the consumer price index is that it more closely tracks with the actual wages paid in Alaska. There have been a number of years that the average weekly wage actually went down when the consumer price index went up slightly. So I believe that this would more closely track the actual wages. We've been stuck for a long time at much lower unemployment benefits than our states that are closest to us. We're number 47 in the nation as far as the replacing the average weekly wage, and we're at 35% of the average weekly wage right now at $248. Washington's at 67%, Hawaii's at 66%. Oregon is at 63 and Idaho at 59. 50% of the average weekly wage would put us at, I think it's about 23rd among the states, so it put us right almost in the middle. What we've been running into with the iron workers and with a number of the skilled trades is that we'll get our apprentices trained and spend the time and the effort to get them trained, and then when they run up on a period of short work in the wintertime, they'll leave and go to Seattle or Portland or San Francisco or Los Angeles, one of those places down there, and the wages are such that they never come back. What we have to do, I believe it's incumbent upon us to do, is to have an unemployment benefit that is more closely pegged to the realities of the Alaskan market, and so that we can retain our skilled workers here, because we're losing them. And we're looking at possibly a Alaska natural gas pipeline. I'd hate to see us not be able to man that job like we weren't able to man the Alaska oil pipeline, because we don't have the skilled workers here. And it's very frustrating for the skilled trades and other people here to train these workers and then lose them to the fact that they can't afford to stay here on the benefits that we pay now. And I'd be open for questions. I'm sure there will be.
Representative Crawford, I'll begin. This is Chairman Anderson for folks on teleconference. This was the bill that I, as Chair of Labor and Commerce, sponsored last year, isn't it? And isn't it commensurate with the rates?
It's very similar to that. It may be, we were trying to keep it at 50%, so I think it's about $16 more than it was last year at the maximum.
And that bill passed that out of the House last year, and it was caught up in the Senate, right?
Right.
Okay. Just so the members remember that. Any questions for the sponsors, Representative Crawford or Guttenberg, or do you want to wait till we have testimony? Representative Ledoux?
Yeah, I came in late, so excuse me. But through the chair, how much is this going to cost employers in raising unemployment insurance rates? Does anybody have any idea about this?
That's better for the. Is there anyone from the Department of? Oh, good. Yep. You wanna? I looked right past you.
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, Committee, I'm Bill Kramer. I'm the Chief of Unemployment Insurance for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I'm here today strictly to try and answer your questions or at least notate what your questions might be and get back to you if that need be. As far as how much this increase would cost the department, the Department of Employers in Alaska, we've estimated that the cost to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund after this was fully in effect, after this increase was fully in effect, would be about $12.4 million a year would be the cost of the trust fund.
And then, Bill, just to supplement that question, and Representative Ledoux may have further questions, then how would that work? So, committee, so we understand, how does that work in terms of you have that amount raised, and then you have to obviously push that to the employers and businesses, and then it's extrapolated out proportionately?
Right. That in Alaska, the financing for our trust fund is shared amongst employers, and 80% is paid by employers, 20% of the cost of benefits is paid for by a tax on workers, so it would be shared across both groups. Employers do pay 80% of the cost, Mr. Chairman, and the it would take a couple of years for the full effect of the increase to be felt. When the full 12.1% of the increase is in effect, which would be by 2010 if this bill went forward as is, it would increase the, for an average employer, for an employer paying the average tax rate, it would increase their tax per worker $64 a year. Is our estimate. All things being equal in the economy, taken on a base year, and nothing else changed in the economy but this, that would be the approximate increase.
And that's 80%, so one-fifth, the employee pays four-fifths, or 80% the employer pays, and you're speculating, no guarantees, but that would be, by 2010, 65 per person. So
right.
If there's 10 employees, it's $650 more in a year that they contribute. To unemployment, hypothetically.
Yes.
Representative Ledoux.
And is that based on a salary of what? Because don't employers and employees, isn't their unemployment, what they pay in unemployment taxes, isn't that based upon their payroll?
Maybe you could explain how that, so the committee members know how that works, just in kind
how
of a nutshell.
How the tax is calculated per employee? If I can I ask Mr. Shire, our chief of tax, to come up maybe and join me here? He's maybe a little better schooled in the tax side of it specifically.
Just the basics after you introduce yourself of how that works. You have a business with three employees. State's going to contact that new business and say, by the way, you owe unemployment and the names and vernacular for that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Patrick Shire. I'm the Chief of Tax and Acting Deputy Director for the Employment Security Division. And to answer your question, the annually, according to statute, we calculate 75% of the average wage, and that is the taxable wage base. And over time, it has gone up and it has gone down. And what we're looking at in terms of these numbers here is based on the average, or 75% of the average weekly wage as contemplated in this bill. So it may increase, but it may also decrease.
Representative Ledoux?
I guess I'm still confused. Right now, if I'm correct, the limit is about $24,000 or maybe?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it's right now $27,000, and that's calculated. All the wages that are paid per individual in the state last year for the rating period are added together, divided by the number of workers, and we come up with an average wage, annual wage. And then we take 75% of that amount. That is the amount upon which UI taxes are levied.
So can I follow up?
Sure.
So I'm not sure if I quite understand how this bill works yet. Does this bill, would this bill increase through the bill? Instead of it being $27,000 the way it is now, would that figure go up to $35,000? Is that what this bill does?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, no. This bill sets the new weekly benefit amount, and the rating system that's in place today doesn't change. However, the rates, we presume that rates would increase to cover the increased expense to the trust fund. So the taxable wage base that Mr. Shire was just speaking to, that would stay in place. It would gradually creep up over time, we expect wages would increase over time. The rate that we multiply against that could increase as a result of the trust fund, increased expense to the trust fund. But the rating system stays in place as it is today, essentially.
I think I understand.
And, last year, Commissioner O'Clery came and testified in support. Is there that same support that there has to be a shift in the unemployment rate? Or can you not speak to that? Representative Crawford? Question or answer to that?
Well, no, I wanted to add to that. I mean, we've been stuck since 96 at 248. Before that, it was 212. I can't remember what year it was that we went from 212 up to 248. How many years between those? I mean, it just seems that, we do have to adjust these at least once a decade, it seems, to just keep people from, being really priced out of the marketplace. They've got to go somewhere else because they can't afford to stay here and pay their bills.
Through the chair, to address your question, the commissioner's been very busy on the workers' comp, and we haven't had a chance to talk to him before we came over here today, and I'd defer that.
Okay. I know he's been working on that, and we'll be hearing that. Tell him thank you for sending that bill to us.
So do you have that year that we went from 212 up?
I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me. I can get that for you. I know that it was January 1st, 1997, when we went to 248. So we're getting 8 years from that last increase. And I'm sure we can identify for you. I just don't have it right at my fingertips.
If you could just, while you're looking, give me an idea of what inflation moved up at the same time, how much we've lost in the earning, buying power with that, you know, staying at 248 rather than being adjusted yearly.
Understand through the chair, Representative Crawford will try to come up with some information for you on the erosion effect of inflation on the amount.
And Bill, should the bill pass out today, then we'll supplement the members with that, and then get it to finance as well as possible. Other questions, Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, you know, there is a number of questions, and I'm a little concerned about your always wanting to support the chair.
But sure.
I would like to see some information provided to this committee. I think the bill package doesn't even have any kind of information that impacts on employers, what those costs are, and I'd like to see those. And I want to see what the impacts are by percentage on a payroll deduction for both employers and employees. There's no collection side information at all in this bill package. There's no statement of a formula of how this impacts the people are paying for it. And I'm very concerned about that. Until I see that, I'm not going to support this bill in any way, shape, or form.
Mr. Roper, Representative Roper, did you contact the chamber? Because I noticed that we have folks from labor, of course, the division representatives, but nobody, and we've advertised this bill for days, nobody from chamber or other sort, those entities are even testifying.
Yes, I have
no
idea.
Maybe you could
it's not my bill, Mr. Chairman. It's not my responsibility to do that. My responsibility is this committee should get all the information as part of a bill package to provide answers to questions. That's all.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
And I find it, I'm a little bit nonplussed here about when I see my payroll cost going up, I want to know what it is, how it is, and what the rationale is. And I get very excited about that. Because I'm looking at this cost me, it's going to cost me $2,000 a year to pay rocking chair money for somebody that wants to take some time off. I'm really not real pleased with that and expect to get paid for it. So, and I'm paying for it. I want to know what I'm paying and why I'm paying it.
Is that something the division, and I'll have you respond, is that something the division can provide? Do you understand Representative Roper's question, kind of the analysis of employer to employee and the maybe?
What's the fiscal impact on employers in the state? There's nothing in this bill package that even shows that. All we have here is a $10,000 increase from $27,000 up to $37,750 that caused the impact.
Sure.
There's over a 30-some percent increase in the benefit here. And there's a huge impact on there's $12.4 million. I want to know what that is to an individual per employee, so we can calculate the impact to a business, so they know what their gross cost would be. I mean, that's not even part of the testimony.
I understand, and I think that if you look at the packet from last year, you might have talk to the commissioner because there was some of that information in there. So,
Mr. Chairman, of course, we understand that we can put something together there.
Did you have a response, Representative Crawford?
Very good. Just one thing. I don't think that the chairman, representative from Spinard, really means that anybody that gets on unemployment is just looking for a little rocking chair time. You know, this is about people that do get laid off and are trying to support their families and keep their house payments up and all throughout the winter if they get laid off due to weather. We've decided a long time ago in this state that that unemployment benefits are essential to trying to retain a workforce and keep people here. So I'm sure he didn't mean that this was just a vacation for workers.
Shaking his head, I hope. Okay, Representative Guttenberg, and then we'll get to the folks standing by to testify.
Thank you. Well, we passed a bill out of this committee. We passed it off the floor today with certainly a lot less information than we have here in front of us on the impacts, because we want to attract and retain what we call key workers, whether they're doctors or welders. I mean, it's a basic part of the foundation of our society going into a hopefully a boom cycle with a gas line. One of the most important things we could do is keep people in this state. This is something that in my construction days was key to what I was doing, my ability to make it from one job to the next. So a lot of people leave this state that could run any job in this state, build a pipeline, build a house, build an office building, school, or road. Unemployment simply wasn't able to hold them over, and they left. And there's a loss of a lot of skilled workers in the state because of where the level of this is. But a question I have to the department is, we're only talking about people who make over $27,000, between $27,000 and $37,000. How many people are actually on the unemployment rolls at a given time, or a yearly average, who actually are above $27,000? Because that's really all you're talking about.
And if you don't have it, you can supplement that too.
I think that specific question I will have to get back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Because isn't that the key to all the assumptions here? I mean, you can put everybody together in a make averages and total numbers and come up with a formula, but in the end, the only group you're talking about is the people making over $27,000. And how long are those people normally unemployed?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the average duration for unemployment that someone's on unemployment in Alaska right now is 14.8 weeks. The average weekly benefit amount right now that's being paid out is $190 per week. And we can come up with some figures for you as far as how many people are at the maximum of the percentage of people filing, how many are actually at the maximum right now and therefore would be impacted by this bill. Your point is accurate in that not everyone will get a higher weekly benefit amount if this bill was in place. It would only affect the people that are earning over the $26,750 a year. Right.
And in the same context, I mean, there's got to be a sliding, a number that somebody on the bottom end of this is basically a minimum wage worker flipping burgers or something, the number of weeks that somebody in the lower end is out of work and somebody in the upper end is normally out of work. I mean, because if you're a highly skilled worker and you're laid off, you're more likely to go back to work sooner. Or maybe that assumption on my part is wrong, but I would like to see, is there a number out there that represents that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, your question is does the average duration that a person receives benefits change relative to the amount that they receive weekly?
Yeah, from the high end, somebody who's maxed out now, technically probably be a fairly skilled worker, to somebody on the low end,
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think I understand your question, and we'll try to put some figures together for the committee. That's a little different take, perhaps, than we've looked at in recent years, but we'll do what
it
we
seems
can.
Like it just seems like some of the basic assumptions you build into a formula, you would, you're not adding to the bottom, you're adding to the top. So there's a different segment of the working society that's actually affected by this.
These dynamics, I think, are important, Representative Ledoux's question on how the unemployment insurance and that extraction works, and then the comparison Representative Roepberg noted with employer versus employee. And I respect what Representative Roepberg said, as much as I'd like to rush this out because of the fact that I endorse it generally and sponsored it last year in a new legislature and without this information being supplemented in the packet. I think it's wise to hold it. And it's a matter, it's not just about employee versus employer. I mean, there are costs both ways. And I think we're cognizant, and Representative Crawford as the lead sponsor and Representative Guttenberg as well as the other prime, I think are looking at employers and employees in the whole, and as policymakers, I think those are good questions. And if you can bring those in next week, then we can continue the dialogue. And so, with that, we'll go to there's a few folks before we go, Representative Crawford, and then we'll go to the four people that want to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you could just, I'm not exactly sure all the information that you're bringing back, but if you could kind of give us a history of the percentage that the these tax rates have climbed over the last two or three decades, because I'm, in the 30 years that I've been here, it seems to me like we've only moved from like $190 up to $248 in almost that whole 30 years that I've been here. I can't remember the maximum ever being under about $190 in that time, and give us an idea of how that relates to the inflation rate and all over time as well. I'd appreciate that.
Great. Thank you.
Through the chair, for clarification, I have the dates when it was increased and the economic impacts of inflation, the cost impacts on employers and employees, and some discussion on how we expect the average taxable wage base to act over the coming years, if there are any impacts of this measure on that.
Correct. And any other, Representative Ledoux, any others?
No, I can't think of anybody, but I would really appreciate getting answers to some of those questions, since I wasn't on this committee last year, so I don't have access to that other
one. Very fair. Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I think I would like to get clarified, or if we could get some examples, perhaps, perhaps at certain levels, if there is, like a percentage change, let's say, the 12,000, 24,000, 34,000, whatever, if there's a differential, what those in kind of a sample impact on the employer and employee about what they're paying and what their expectations would be for any benefits. Also, if there's any kind of, you talk about the average time they may be unemployed, I guess one of my concerns is there, I think we'd like to, I'd like to have some further debate on the rationale behind indicating that this type of benefit is a matter of retaining a skilled workforce vis-a-vis providing interim benefits to support that worker until he can become reemployed. I mean, there seems to be like a structure, assumption of certain employment categories where these benefits are part of their annualized income, and they almost plan on it, versus the other portion of the workforce who might have a more steady year-round type income and only loses employment because of unforeseen circumstances or whatever might cause that person to lose a job. Is there any kind of records or is any basis in viewing job categories as a portion of the benefits paid out to the whole trust fund? Or any statistical analysis of that type of thing?
Through the chair, Representative, we do have some industry-specific
that
cost
might be
of benefits.
With that. I don't want to create much extra work, but if you have some good analysis that's based on that, it might be interesting for the committee to see that. Just quite frankly, I don't know, Mr. Kramer, maybe you could speak to it, Mr. Chairman, about this issue of the philosophy behind the payment of unemployment compensation and what its real purpose is. Is there a mission statement we have in our private sector fiscal note here that's costing the public? What are we trying to accomplish here? I'm kind of curious about that.
And that goes to Representative Ledoux's question, kind of the process that maybe you can bring back on a mission.
Right, don't try to answer it. I mean, just maybe a heads up. I think it's something that deserves to be discussed.
We'll see you in a decade. Is that okay at this stage?
We've got our homework assignment. Through the chair, Representative Roper, certainly we can bring back some information on the mission statement, purpose of the program, the goals of the program, both for our state and nationally.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think there were some other graphs that may be in your files that might show also why there would be a further need comparatively from Alaska to other states. I mean, to make the case for an increase, if in fact we're showing one, there's one chart in here. How we compare to there's other things. It's not just the average weekly wage. It's actually the payout of the average, like you mentioned, $190. That's different than the 240 max, 48 maximum benefit. So is there any kind of a comparative analysis on a state-by-state basis between what their average payout is versus ours? Or I think I recall some other type of analysis like that. Because here we're just looking at on the one in the file, we're just looking at the highest payout, as I understand it, the maximum weekly benefit amount. That's not what we're actually paying out to the workers.
To the chair, Representative Roper,
right?
That's accurate. I think the chart shows our Alaska's ranking nationally with the maximum weekly benefit amount. The maximum weekly benefit amount is just that, the maximum. It's not the average. So we I think could show information based more on the average, if that would help.
Well, I think it would. I think it's just some other comparative analysis to see where we're at.
Your point is that when you look at a figure, whether we're number one, we're at the bottom, we're in the middle, you're saying that's not exact. Maybe that's an amount that's paid, but there are other factors. It's not
just
that.
Like the average amount paid out, the $190 would be more important than the maximum amount. It's what the average worker is getting. I mean, is that a good amount? I mean, that's, I think, is a better argument than just the maximum amount. Because the way the bill's put together, it just increases the maximum amount.
Right.
Are we not? We're not helping the lower income person here, are we? I mean, the way this bill is structured. Say, right, if the guy that makes $20,000 a year, mm-hmm, or a poor legislator that makes $24,000 a year. What? For example, I mean, he's not going to. Would this bill help that person any?
Through the chair, Representative Rockberg, elected officials are excluded from coverage.
Somebody in that range, though, I mean, $24,000 a year. Yeah. You know, my understanding of reading is there wouldn't be any impact or on that person who would have lost his job and needs the benefit.
Through the chair.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
So is that just what you guys want to do? I don't know.
Final analysis, and then we'll get to testifying.
We had talked about moving the benefit, the maximum benefit down to the $27,000, the maximum where it is today, and that would step it down to the lower workers. They also said that would be much, much more expensive to the trust fund than what we're talking about. And what we're trying to do is maintain a person's average, 50% of the average weekly wage. If we did it that way, it would maintain a much larger percentage of the people at the bottom end. I don't know if you want to do it that way, it would be okay with me. We were just doing it because that was the cheaper way to go overall, to raise the maximum. So those people that are at past the $27,000 level now, are, you know, their expenses are pegged to their income, undoubtedly. I mean, just about everybody's is. So they're only, the people at the maximum are only able to get 35% of their wages, and that's not enough to continue on paying their bills and making their house payments. So.
Mr. Real brief, just so we can get to.
It might be interesting to see if the sponsors' bills have made a judgment about the cost. It might be interesting for having it in the record that in order to raise the lower scale up, it would have cost this amount. We ought to have that debate, I think.
Okay.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
I'd love to lower it. Raise the lower end as
sounds
well.
Sounds like Representative Roper has an amendment to include all workers.
Which would be excellent.
$100 million here, $200 million there.
No, okay. We'll get real quick now. Ray, Royce, Dave, and John. I know you can't respectively answer this, but I'll just say I want to keep obviously public testimony open. But why don't you guys limit, if you could, really brief your thoughts, and then I'll give you one more chance in the future as this bill evolves next week. To communicate again, but out of fairness, so there's not duplicity, real brief just presentation on your thoughts on the bill and the general philosophy of it, and then we'll keep the public testimony open. And we'll start with John Brown first in Fairbanks, then Ray, Royce, and Dave in Anchorage.
To the chair, this is John Brown, members of the committee. I live in Fairbanks. I'm a business agent for the operating engineers and president of the Central Labor Council. Appreciate the time to talk. This bill is third or fourth year, and most of the members of this committee have seen this bill many times, debated it many times. It hasn't changed. The Department of Labor is also put out some pretty good figures about the shortage of skilled workers in this state, And unemployment undoubtedly allows our state to retain some of those workers. And if the members of the committee don't quite get that, let me see if I can help them. I'll give you an example of one gentleman that I know in my industry, the operating engineers. We run heavy equipment, very expensive equipment, very expensive to operate, very expensive to train someone to operate that equipment. And so you get a worker, a trained worker in our industry who gets laid off and has to leave the industry because he has to pay, gets a job. I can give you an example of one person that I remember very clearly. He left to take a job at about 30% less in wages, but it was a year-round job and he didn't get laid off. And he had to do it. He said, I just can't do construction because I can't get by from one job to the next. And our construction employers in this state spent thousands of dollars training him to become an operator, and then they lost him. And we have a very competitive construction industry in Alaska, which allows the state to save money on their public works projects by having that industry. But it would be even more competitive if we kept our workforce instead of having to retrain people, especially in my industry. And I don't know if anyone's seeing my point here, but we have to have a way to get people through their jobless, you know, when they get laid off in the construction industry, to get to the next job. Otherwise, it costs us more money in the long run. And that's true for a lot of industries. So, I urge you to pass this bill today. There's no reason for this committee to hold it. You guys have seen this thing half a dozen times. It needs to go on. It gets been held 3 years in a row here. Please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, John. No questions at this time for John. Ray Smith in Anchorage.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Raymond Smith. I'm the business manager of the Painters and Allied Trades Local Union 1140 here in Anchorage. I, again, would urge passage of this bill. We've been to this office, I hate to say how many times, over this same issue. The people, the unemployment needs to be raised. I know when I, and you'll forgive me, when I drew my rocking chair in between jobs, it allowed me the barely the leeway to pay some of my bills in the interim until I found another job. And it doesn't. I'm not. I didn't go to Hawaii and lay on the beach. I had to feed my family and get out and find another job. We live in the construction industry, and it is not a year-round business. We have time off, not only to weather, but to jobs. You finish a job, if the other one isn't ready to start yet, we can go home. So I again urge you, please pass this bill and let's go forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Ray. And like I said, John, Ray, and Royce, and Dave, if there's something pressing next week, I'll let you give you another chance to respond to statistics and data that we compile from the division. Royce Rock, my friend, I missed you while you were in Juneau. I apologize for that.
I'll be back down, it sounds like.
Okay, welcome.
I'd also urge you to pass this, to hold it over. You know, we have been here. The word I think of myself and some other labor leaders here is tenacious. We have continually come back and to have it be asked to be heard over again or held over again, especially by somebody that has been on the committee every year, is kind of ironic to me, I guess, that we'd need to do that. You know, we talk about the cost of this to the unemployment division at $12.4 million, but 20% of that is paid by the employees, and you've got to keep in mind we're one of the very few states that actually does that. The other thing about it is unemployment right now, as is at the top rate, is $996. I'd have to challenge you to find anybody that has a house payment that's $996 a month in the city of Anchorage, Kodiak, Fairbanks, Juneau, anywhere in the state. this isn't getting it the way it's going right now with these wages. We're a laughing stock when you go outside and talk about unemployment. You know, Representative Roekberg asked what the accomplished, what are we trying to accomplish? Unemployment was set up not just for the worker, but it was for the economic community's welfare. And it sustains the economy why people are out of work as much as it sustains the worker itself. This benefits everybody. If there's anything that I disagree with this bill, it is putting the top level at the $37,750. Now, if you want to go back to where that came from, it was through negotiations about 2 years ago when we were willing to take the amount up of the average or the wage you had to make to get the high end, and it somehow got put into this bill. Now, whether I agree with it or not, I agree with the intent of the whole bill. But if you look at it, at the average wage of a worker, it's still $35,000 a year. So that's not even up to the maximum amount that is needed to get the maximum in unemployment. I urge the passage of this. Every year, the House has been stand-up people, passed it out, and has gone to the Senate. And, you know, in my recollection, and I am getting old, the Senate has never heard it. So it has been said that you spent too much time in the House to get it to the Senate for them to have time to act on it. One time it was just put in the pocket and said not to hear it. I think this thing has to get some feet, get moving. Everybody knows it's the right thing to do. Let's quit playing games and politics on this and move forward. I urge you to pass it on. Thank you very much.
Royce, I want to object. You're not old. You're young.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to speak to this issue about whether we're holding the bill over or moving it out today. For those people on teleconference and in the audience, we do have one new member on this committee, Representative Ledoux. She's not heard this issue before. Additionally, the better debate and arguments that the sponsors and everybody can have on this issue in this committee, this is the committee that should do the most of the heavy lifting on this bill and provide a good packet and a good foundation for this bill to go forward, the better off your chances are. So I'm not going to stand in the way of this bill per se, but I don't think I'm doing even the sponsors any good by not making sure these questions are not answered. And
through the chair, I appreciate what you're saying, and all I'm saying is with your years of working on this and being involved in this, I would ask you to help Representative Ledoux, as I have several people over, members over in Kodiak, and she knows the seasonal nature of the work, especially over there. And I just urge you people that have listened to us talk on this thing for 4 or 5 years to bring her up to speed on this instead of holding this over. I understand debate is good. I don't have a problem with that. It's just this particular bill has been debated to death, and that's what's happened two of the years is it's been debated so long the Senate used the excuse of not enough time to deal with it. I don't want that to happen again. Thank you.
And Representative Roper, just as the chair, I totally concur in terms of procedure and in terms of the work of the committee. But I will say also that you've asked some substantive questions, and you're more familiar with labor and commerce issues than probably anyone in the legislature. I compliment you 100%. And so for me, when you ask those questions with sub-tiers and categories, they're good questions. But I think what some of the members, or pardon me, some of the testifiers are saying is, if anyone should know, you know, Roekberg should know. I mean, he's an expert.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing in this packet here that shows what the impact of businesses are. I mean, there's absolutely inexcusable, in my opinion, not to at least have that in this bill pack.
And I think Representative Crawford inadvertently didn't include that, and will supplement it from the.
We'd be glad to try to answer any questions that you have.
No, I agree. That's what I'm saying here.
Sure, and we'll do that. No, that's.
I'm not griping here.
No. Some of your these people are. I mean, you know.
Well,
they
don't have
folks mind. We're debating.
It's been years, so they can gripe.
Well, I haven't seen this. Actually, this was 2 years ago. I don't have the bill file. I don't have those numbers in front of me. That's all I'm asking.
Okay.
Even
well, we'll get
I'm
that next
familiar
week.
With the issue, I don't have the numbers. I don't.
The division, I don't carry these files around from 2 years ago.
No, that's fine. The division will bring it.
I think it's clear. I'm a genius, but not that smart.
Okay.
I used to be. I forgot more than I know.
Okay, we'll go to Dave Ford. Dave Ford is such a nice fellow. It's great to end with him because he'll calm us all down.
Okay. This is David Ford. I'm the business manager of the Iron Workers. Alaskans that work in construction, especially in the more weather-challenged environments of the state, cannot support their families during the long winter months of unemployment on the current compensation. Frequently what happens is the employer retains their longest employed seasoned veteran employees as they lay off for the winter. The apprentice or the least skilled or lowest paid employee and the potential future workforce of Alaska, I might add, are the ones that get laid off first. And we're forcing those young people to leave Alaska to pay their bills, and like Representative Crawford said, many do not return. This winter, for the iron workers, the young workers headed to Hawaii to work. Will they all return? I don't know yet. When we do roll call on Monday morning for apprenticeship class, we'll find out how many of them do come back. Current rates of compensation are especially burdensome to rural Alaskans that come into Anchorage or Fairbanks for seasonal employment, but due to the short duration of the many construction projects, may need to bridge the gap between one project to the next. They're dependent on the unemployment check to maintain both their temporary housing and their permanent place back home. Those of you that have traveled in construction know the value of the fair compensation of an unemployment check. I'm in favor of passage of this bill, and thanks for allowing my testimony.
Thank you, Dave. No questions at this time. Is there anyone else wishing to testify, recognizing that we'll keep the public hearing open for into next week and onward? Seeing none, then I will keep it open. Representative Roper's questions will be supplemented here hopefully next week from the division, and Representative Crawford actually had a question, as did Representative Ledoux, and I think we will have that expeditiously. I recognize the folks want the bill to move on because it's a long trail and it is duplicative to past years, even though we don't have the full file, as Representative Roper noted, before us now. So we'll hold the bill, and we'll go to just one other. Are there any comments before we hold Representative Redbird?
Well, did Representative Crawford have something to say?
We're just holding it, but sure, you can.
Okay, I want to make one comment and about unemployment. You know, some people consider it an employer's bill. I mean, you take a highly skilled construction employee who works seasonal, might get hired in May at the start of a season, might have 5 or 10 years of training, on-the-job training, schooling, 5 years of an apprenticeship program, works till maybe September, maybe October, maybe November, maybe switches jobs, and kind of the construction goes from building trades to pipeline, goes up north in the winter. Contractor needs that personnel, he needs that training. That little bit of stipend keeps that person in town on call. You don't have the ability to go someplace else and make the kind of money you do in construction, highly skilled, working in an environment that other people won't work in. A contractor relies on having those people in place. Now, if you went to work someplace else and you got a call from your contractor who's probably could be paying you twice what you might be taking in the interim, You're gonna cut the legs out from under that contractor, and of course jump up north. I go outside and I tell people that my union that I retired at is 500 people in that membership that any given day would think nothing of going outside and working year round at 30 or 40 below, and people cannot believe it. When it comes time to build a pipeline, another line, you're going to have people coming up here who have highly skilled that will not even know what a bunny boot or a felt pack is. You're going to, and no matter how highly skilled they are, they're not going to be able to respond to the environment. And it's going to be the long-term Alaskan that's sitting out there doing every job from the most menial to the most skilled. And employers are the people that need that the most. If you were one of those skilled employers and could find comparable skills to work someplace else during, you would do it. You're not sitting on a rocking chair. You're not doing something else. You're waiting for that job to come back up, and you're in that more often than not, you're sitting in that union hall or you're on the phone to your contractor every day. What's going on? What's happening? And your contractor's sitting there telling you, you know, we're bidding, we're whatever the process is, and everybody's waiting, and everybody's on hold. This little bit of money that keeps people in this state poised to go back to work in those conditions, whether it's an oil rig, any type of all the seasonal construction that happens, it's critical. And in this document back here that is in the bill packet from the Trends magazine talks about that. And it calls, where is that? It calls it a cushion in society. And I think that's a major consideration for what it is. It doesn't keep people rocking on their rocking chair or sitting on your thumbs just waiting. People want to work. And the concept that people on unemployment are just sitting here collecting unemployment because they can get a free check belittles the fact that there's a workforce out there that has no other choice than to work seasonal or whatever they can get and be ready to work the next job. So I just take exception to people who call working on their sitting in their rocking chair. And I think the role of unemployment has fallen on labor, but it could easily as fall on the contractors who need people on standby months on end every year waiting to go to work.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reason why I think we're way behind in this state is we're at 35% of the average weekly wage. Way back in 1935, my father was a printer and was working on a newspaper in Longview, Texas, and was making $36 a week. That was the scale, the union scale at that time. That paper folded. He went to, he got laid off and got unemployment. His unemployment check then was $18 a week. That was 50% of the average weekly wage, his average weekly wage at the time. That was in the height of the Depression. Surely we should be able to come up with 50% of the average weekly wage here in Alaska when times aren't nearly as hard as that. So that's my reasoning.
And I appreciate all the dialogue, and I look forward to next week's analysis. It's interesting, Representative Roperick and I have a mutual friend, Trina Johnson, who owns the Lomex chain. There's three stores, but in decades she's owned that, her family has, and she wrote an email to me last week stating that because of workers' comp issues and unemployment insurance and kind of a mix, even though we say that these small fees don't affect cumulatively, they do, and she had to close her downtown store. And that's not in response to what you and Representative Guttenberg said, but there's a balance on both ends, and that's sad because I'm sure she didn't retain all those employees at the Diamond and Spinard locations. So if we can work this out and get the statistics, hopefully we can move it on and help those in this dire strait and also work with employers as well. And I appreciate Representative Roperick's concern to supplement and yours as well. We'll hold the bill. And poor Linda's been diligently waiting here. We'll get to her next with House Bill 147 and just your presentation. You do.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering, yeah. Unemployment insurance is the only insurance that Director Hall doesn't regulate in this state?
I think so. I don't have anything to do with it.
State your name and how sick of you are of this committee for the record.
My name is Linda Hall. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance, and I love this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here today to speak to House Bill 147, which is better known as the Omnibus Insurance Bill. I thought that was a better title when they were 60-page long bills. I've tried really hard to keep them to a minimum. The bill, for the most part, is a combination of technical cleanups, some new provisions, and what I've tried to do in my presentation today, knowing the fairly technical nature of insurance, is to break out the portions by kind of the types of issues it covers. Generally, the insurance bill proposes statutory changes that will make the regulation of insurance more efficient for the division, more uniform for industry, and at the same time, provide increased protection for Alaska consumers. One of the sections in the bill deals with licensing, and there are a variety of sections. I believe you have a sectional analysis. The major change in the licensing sections, and I can identify them if you'd like, but it's probably more boring than you want to hear. Generally, what we've done here is no longer require insurance companies to file their appointments with the Division of Insurance. We are asking them to keep lists, and if we should take regulatory action, pull their certificate of authority, then we would require that they notify their agents that they are no longer authorized to do business in this state. We will also require that they keep lists of their appointed agents in their files and that be given to the Division of Insurance upon request. Second area of changes deals with surplus lines. I think as we've talked about insurance before, we have two kinds of insurance. One are called admitted companies that file their forms, file their rates, pay premium tax. The other kind are called surplus lines or unauthorized insurers. And in that process, we made a number of changes last year in the bill. There are a few things that we apparently overlooked, and thus we have made some cleanups in this section, generally to documents that are filed either with the division or that are filed with that placement of insurance. There are minor changes in insured deposits in sections 3, 4, and 5. We are removing the never-used option of safety deposit boxes. Insurers don't put their cash in a safety deposit box, so we're taking that out. And we also are permitting the release of the deposit directly to the guarantee fund where the right of the deposit is assigned to that fund so that the guarantee fund can get the money from the deposit of an insolvent insurer. There are two sections, section 30 and 33, that deal with products dealing with the auto industry, service contracts, and a product called Guaranteed Auto Protection. This section has been the topic of some discussion with auto dealers. It is, in the past, the division has looked at products on a case-by-case basis, and we're now seeking to put together some standards that we can use across the board to allow us to have a more uniform review of those products. So the sections really clarify our authority to promulgate regulations for licensing, product standards, financial responsibility, and adds a definition for both guaranteed auto protection and auto service contracts. This section I would anticipate being the subject of further discussion and potentially some revision to wording. It's not my intent to create havoc in the auto industry, but I do need to have some oversight authority. Number of other sections, section 20, 21, and 22, deal with health discount plans. These are plans that are not health insurance, but they are sold using terminology very similar to health insurance. Nationally, from 2000 to 2002, over 200,000 of these plans were sold, leaving approximately $250 million in unpaid claims. Our goal in these three sections is to make specific...
I'm sorry, did you go $250 million?
Nationally.
Nationally,
okay. Yes. We would be really in trouble if that happened here. And I'm going to call it a scheme. Nationally, we refer to it as fraudulent insurance, illegal insurance, fake insurance. You probably, if you listen to radio or sometimes on late-night TV, will see these advertised. Faxed out for $79.99, you too can buy this wonderful plan. And it uses the same terminology of insurance, but doesn't ever use that word. We are adding specific reference in this proposed language to these health discount plans to bring them under our unfair trade practices chapter, to add standards for the marketing, promotion, advertisements, and to the other piece that we found interesting, and we do have some of these that have been sold in Alaska, they propose to have a network of providers that you can go and see a doc and get a discount. the providers that are listed in their advertising material have never heard of them. So, I mean, this is something I also have worked with the Medical Association to alert them to these kinds of schemes. So that's another big section of this.
Representative Rokeberg.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Hall, is this the type of thing that they're advertising, that they have a, say, a closed panel, and therefore you pay a small monthly amount, not a premium because it's not insurance, but we will allow you to use these healthcare providers at a discounted rate? So they're like closed panels in a managed care or an HMO plan that they have under contract, or what?
Through the chair, I've not heard the closed panel terminology used with these. They're merely an anybody. There's no waiting period. There's no pre-existing conditions. None of those things. And we'll,
a discount rate from a provider, is that the?
A discount, like you might get 10% off your office visit, I'm going to say unsophisticated consumer who's looking for a way to find cheaper health insurance is likely to fall prey, thinking they're really buying health insurance. And I guess when we get the complaints, we have a place on our website, at the division website, that actually talks about these plans. And I would caution, and when I speak to consumer groups, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. And so we're trying to encourage consumers to use our website to call us to check on the validity of that offer and the insurer.
To just follow up, so these are generally fraudulent schemes. None of them, have you ever found one that's actually worked?
Through the chair, there are a couple discount plans that are affiliated with legitimate insurers.
Okay.
So there are some that may be legitimate. The majority of them are not.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. It looks like everything starts off with one good one and everybody takes advantage of it. But my question with the health discount plans is, how do you regulate somebody that has no presence in the state? You know, they are on a national broadcast, 1-800 on radio or late night television. How do you?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. That is a problem. We are working with other states to do that, and they are frequently a fax number and a phone. And we do in other states have put companies out of business, and they pop up in the same office with a new fax number under a new name. And it takes, I think, the concerted effort that we put forth with other states so that if we get a complaint, we also are entering a national database and working in conjunction with investigators in other states to try to truly put them out of business. We have to have the statutory authority to do that. But it wouldn't be, my investigators are not going to Texas to close them down, but they will work with the Texas Department of Insurance to do that.
So you have ways of tracking down as far as where their base of operation is or where the 800 number is, because it might be in the Grand Caymans or someplace.
Through the chair, if it's in the Grand Caymans, we have a more difficult problem. If they're in this country, it's easier.
Probably an easier time getting somebody to go check out the office if it's in the Grand Caymans.
Well, that's a possibility.
Do these 800 numbers show up on our television here in Alaska and on our radio broadcasts and on our magazines here in Alaska?
Yes, they do.
So do you, as a follow-up, do you issue cease and desist orders to the magazines and the broadcast companies?
No, we've never done that to the actual companies that do that.
I mean, cease and desist orders to the broadcasters.
No, we have never done that.
Is there a reason why you haven't done that?
I'm not sure that we ever thought about doing it to the broadcaster, frankly. But it's something I would certainly be willing to explore. I don't want these plans sold here. I think we have escalating costs of health insurance, and people want some protection, and if the provider is not going to be there to actually follow through on that promise, we need to be able to stop that. Thank you. Next section of that I want to talk about are predominantly found in sections 28 and 29 of the bill. These are called self-funded governmental insurance plans. And what I would say on this particular section, the division had initiate a review of the State Union Health Trust in the spring to determine to what extent they were regulated and how they were regulated under the insurance code. That review that we did has given rise to a desire to clarify state regulation in this area. This Section 28 in particular provides some filing requirements for financial analysis and solvency regulation, provides some minimum standards, including reserving and other typical provisions for that providers of health care expenses are have followed, and we are seeking the authority to have that type of regulatory oversight of the Union Health Trust. The other last major section of changes in this bill are provisions dealing with third-party administrators. Third-party administrators are entities that perform basically administrative functions for an insurer or a self-funded health insurance plan or some entity that needs administration of a plan. And those third-party administrators today are required to be registered. A number of sections, there are probably 7 or 8 sections of this bill, clean up some of the references. It removes the requirement for an insurer to be registered because we already have oversight of the insurer. It does add a requirement that exempt entities certify their eligibility for exemption, and that is in the current statute. It also authorizes the director to immediately suspend the registration of a TPA if the TPA is either financially impaired or engaged in practices that are injurious to policyholders. So we're trying to strengthen our authority and still make the TPA system work, but we want to know who is out there operating in our state in this capacity. And the last, I have about 3 sections that are, I would just categorize as other. We have added in Section 24 the same standards for rate making in the health insurance industry as in other lines of insurance. It's the basic rate making philosophy that rates should neither be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. That is language in every other line of insurance that we regulate and pretty typical around the country. Sections 26 and 27 deal with some minor changes in title insurance that authorize the director's designee to accept financial statements, and it also requires them to provide financial statements quarterly within 45 days. Currently, it's 60. All other insurance companies have to provide us their quarterly financial statements within 45 days of the end of the quarter, and we'd like to make that uniform.
Oh. Representative Roachberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking for the one word change that I don't see it in here. It happened about 4 years ago. You didn't decide to clean that up?
Which one word change?
Title insurance?
No, I didn't. Through the chair. Through the chair.
Just checking with you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. When you just did, looking at the section now, Section 24 requires that health rates for health insurance policies not be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. How does this relate to credit rating, which has been a situation we've talked about bills here in the past? Does this allow you to disallow credit rating used in insurance rates?
Credit scoring.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, no, it would not. We have specific statutory language that allows credit scoring with particular parameters, with particular exemptions, and this would not, this particular language that we're proposing in this bill applies only to health insurance. Those rating standards are in our statutes already for property casualty lines, but that it doesn't, would not prohibit credit scoring, as I said, because of the specific provisions that are already in statute allowing credit scoring under particular parameters.
Not follow up. Not meaning to. You represent the industry. I mean, you represent the administration. There are people here that come before us that represent the industry. is there any place in the state, whether it's in your department or under ACBURG or somebody that has their sole mission for their job as a consumer advocate in the insurance industry?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we have in our division, I don't know that I think it's consumer advocacy, but we have a consumer services section whose main, only job, actually, is to review consumer complaints. If they think they have been treated unfairly, we review statutes, regulations, enter into discussions with insurance companies to see that they are obeying our statutes and regulations, they are following those procedures. We do not get into contractual disputes between the insured and the insurer, although over each year the division efforts to work with consumers generates in the $100,000 to $300,000 worth of additional payments that they had not already received. So I think we do perform that function. When I did the overview of our department a few weeks ago, it's one of the balances that we keep. First and foremost, our mission is to protect and educate the consumers. On the other side, it is also part of our mission to seek to have a healthy insurance environment. And those do require a balance. And the needs of the consumers are the first thing on my staff's mind when we look at filings, when we look at rates. But we have actuarial analysis, but we have statutes and regs, and our predominant role with consumers is to make sure insurance companies are following those statutes and regulations in the way they're being treated.
Madam Chair,
I
have a point. I would suggest this committee and the legislature is one of the chief consumer advocates for insurance matters in the state.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions for Ms. Hall? Then let me call brief at ease.
Thank you.
Today, so unless anybody on the committee has any further comments, I'm going to adjourn this meeting. It is 20 minutes to 5.
Good job. Good.